On this week's program, we talked to Carrie Cheshire about what's really going on with family separations at the border. Charles Blaine will tell us about what happens when voters don't approve a tax increase. Attorney and writer Mark Pulliam joins us to talk about his perspective on the Masterpiece Cake Shop case in the Supreme Court. And Michael Quinn Sullivan will close us out with this week's commentary. Thanks for joining me for this week's episode of Texas Scorecard Radio. I'm your host, Tony McDonald, coming to you from the 1836 studios. We'll get started with this week's news. For that, I've got Carrie Cheshire with Texans for Fiscal Responsibility in the studio. I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the coverage we've been putting out on this issue of separation of families down at the border, trying to inject a little bit of realism and a little bit of solutions into that debate. And tell us a little bit about what's going on.
Right, Tony. So the Trump administration long, you know, held to be border hawks, people who are going to actually enforce the law and kick illegal immigrants out of this country, is actually doing that. They're actually enforcing immigration law by prosecuting those who come here illegally. And one of the problems in doing so is that those who come with children, whether they're their children or other children, had always just been released in the United States just because of a court ruling that said you can't incarcerate these kids.
Yeah, this is the old catch and release policy applied in other contexts, but particularly in the context of adults with children, and really problematic whenever you think about it.
Right. It's problematic towards the enforcement of immigration laws in that it makes it very, very difficult to actually remove illegal immigrants. And it's problematic in that it encourages further illegal immigration and perhaps child exploitation by people using other people's children as political pawns and shields towards preventing the enforcement of the law.
Yeah, that's one of the disturbing things here is a lot of proposals say, well, we've got to release these adults and children. You don't know that these are families. You don't know that these are people who are actually related. These could be child traffickers, you know, people interested in exploiting children. So you have that situation. But even beyond that, from a rule of law perspective, we can't turn children into, you know, amnesty tokens, basically. If bring a child and we'll let you get away with it. It's like if we said that to bank robbers, we'd all, well, of course, they would be taking children into the banks. You know, it doesn't work. It doesn't make sense. And so what are some of the solutions that are being proposed to actually deal with this from a realistic perspective?
Right. So I think everyone agrees that obviously you don't want to separate parents from their children, especially those who are coming here seeking political asylum, whether it's genuine or not. You don't want to separate those children. That's why Senator Ted Cruz came out with a piece of legislation that said, hey, we're going to keep these people together. We're going to expedite the proceedings of the asylum of cases, so we'll know in 3 weeks whether you get to stay or you need to be deported together back to your home country. And we're going to get some more immigration judges to be able to clear this backlog, because right now, you know, people are released into American society. They're told, hey, show up in a month, show up in 2 months. And, of course, they never show up again.
Yeah, right. Now, I saw the proposal from Senator Cruz is definitely the best thing on the table, certainly at the time and kind of since it was unveiled. It still kind of looks like the best proposal on the table. And I immediately thought, everybody's going to agree with this, and they're going to give it to somebody else and put somebody else's name on it. That's proving kind of true.
Kind of true. So two kind of problems with that point. One, the swamp creatures in D.C., all of the Democrats are united in opposition against Senator Ted Cruz's law because it's too common sense. What they were rallying around was a piece of legislation by California Democrat Dianne Feinstein that would have made it illegal to arrest anyone within 100 miles of the border if they had a kid. You're driving around drunk, you got a kid, you can't be detained. Just an absolutely astounding piece of law. The other thing is you're absolutely right in the sense that there are a lot of Republicans who are going around that's like, oh, well, you know, this is actually a good idea, but we don't want to give Ted Cruz the credit for it. And so, you know, kind of Senate Republican leadership is cherry-picking pieces of the law and creating different legislative vehicles with different people's names on them. I think Ted Cruz would tell you he just wants the legislation to pass regardless of whose name is on it.
Right.
But it's very interesting to watch, you know, kind of the sausage getting made up in the swamp.
Yeah, now, with the president taking some executive action on this, is a bill even necessary? Tell us about that.
Well, absolutely. So the president is basically asking the court, hey, can we hold these people together and move these things along, the court's going to come in and say, no, we've already ruled on this decades ago. That's why George W. Bush's administration, Barack Obama's administration, had the policy of catch and release. The need for a legislative fix is still there.
It's a legislative fix because the judiciary has a policy that they've imposed for two or three decades that just doesn't work.
Absolutely.
Well, thanks for joining us, Kerry. Thanks for your reporting on this issue. Listeners, definitely go check out Kerry's writing, my writing, some of the other things we have up at TexasScorecard.com. A lot to unpack on this issue and a lot of real things to talk about beyond all of the talking heads on the cable news.
Thanks, Tony.
Next, let's go down to our friend Charles Blaine in the Bayou City. Charles, you got a great piece up about what happens whenever taxpayers don't approve the proposed tax increase.
Hey, Tony. Yeah, so it's real exciting. We have a district out here called Klein ISD, which decided to throw up a tax increase election of 9 cents, and they did it with just 4 weeks' notice. They, you know, voted on it in the board, and then 4 weeks later held the election. And voters shot it down 55-44. So now they're kind of scrambling to find other cuts and prioritizing spending, you know, things they should have done before.
And of course, you know, there's two kind of competing things. The good story, the really great news, is the victory of taxpayers. You have a local government who says, hey, let's throw up this tax election in the middle of the summer. And voters say, no, I don't want to vote for higher taxes. I'm against higher taxes. So that's a really good thing to see voters respond quickly and ably to defeat a kind of rush to increase taxes. But the really interesting thing here is, of course, they're rushing to increase taxes because it's pandemonium. It's a panic. Everything, the world is going to fall apart if the tax increase is not adopted. That's always the message from taxing entities. What's going to happen since the world apparently is going to end with the tax not being approved?
Well, if you listen to the things that they've been putting out, the documents they've been sending, you would think that the world is coming to an end and the district is going to fall apart. So they've been kind of piecemealing different areas to make up $30 million in cuts. I think the most telling thing, though, out of these cuts is that they were kind of just staggering them and doing different cuts here and there. But the least amount of cuts are coming from the central administration. So they're doing about $6 million in central administration. But when it comes to cutting benefits for teachers and pay raises and things like that, they're cutting $8 million from that area. So the least amount is coming from, you know, where the most overhead is, really.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's been a growing problem with public schools in Texas. The percentage of spending that goes to the classroom has progressively gotten smaller and smaller. More funding goes to the central administration or other administrative people. We all kind of know the experience of various assistant principals all running around trying to manage things, not teaching children. And so they're focusing their cuts on the teachers instead of focusing it on the central administration.
Right. Yeah, they're given most of the cuts to the teachers, unfortunately, and to district on-campus staff. But we do see some bright sides with the cuts that they're making. They are going to be doing different cuts in eliminating cell phone allowances and those kind of computer programs that where they buy new desktops and laptops on an annual basis. They're also eliminating incentive programs. So they are doing some genuine cuts that are nice to see, but it is frustrating to see that the teachers are getting the brunt of it, where you know that the superintendents are making the couple $100,000 a year and all the other kind of heavy level administrative guys are bringing home the big bucks and they're not getting the cuts. But we do see some positives out of this reform. So it's nice to see that the district voters shot it down and now they're actually forced to really take a hard look at where they're spending their money.
Yeah, I think the lesson here is maybe they should have been looking at these cuts in the first place and they would have had more credibility with the voters. But thank you for your reporting on that. Thank you for joining us, Charles.
Thank you.
Texas Scorecard Radio is a project of Empower Texans. At TexasScorecard.com or EmpowerTexans.com, you can find more news and daily updates from all around the Lone Star State. You can also find updates from Empower Texans and Texas Scorecard on Facebook and Twitter, and follow Empower Texans on Instagram. Texas Scorecard's News Digest goes out weekly via email and monthly in print. Subscribe online and find more information at EmpowerTexans.com. Someone's always keeping score. We think it ought to be the taxpayers.
Well, it's my pleasure to welcome on the program this week Mark Pulliam, attorney and author with Misrule of Law, a chronicle of legal and judicial mischief. Thanks for joining us, Mark.
Well, thank you, Tony, for having me.
Well, I wanted to have you on to talk about your analysis. You did a great article called Having Your Cake and Eating It Too about the Masterpiece Cake Shop case that came out of the Supreme Court earlier this month. And I just wanted to have you on. So much of the analysis of that case was so shallow, was so uninteresting, and I thought your piece really cut at the heart of the issue. So let's talk a little bit about what that case means, and particularly what it means relative vis-a-vis to Justice Anthony Kennedy, the justice who authored the opinion.
Well, I knew something was up when the case was argued in early December, and Kennedy, who normally is the swing vote, he's sort of the fulcrum of the court, and a lot of people read into his questions.
Right.
What direction he's going. And at the oral argument, he asked some very pointed questions and made some comments to the lawyers representing the state of Colorado, which is the state whose Human Rights Commission prosecuted this claim against Jack Phillips, the baker, the Christian baker from Colorado. And the nature of his questions were, how can you defend these comments that the commission, certain commissioners made while they were processing the claim against him, referring to his religious objections to making a same-sex wedding cake as despicable?
Right.
And I agree that that is despicable, but I was really surprised to hear that coming from Tony Kennedy, who has been the architect of the court's recognition of gay rights as a constitutional right, and this has been his agenda going back 20 years.
Yeah,
or more.
I mean, this was Anthony Kennedy, an appointee of Ronald Reagan, expected to be a conservative jurist on the court, and has systematically built a legal regime around gay rights, going back through pretty much authoring every major opinion on the issue up through Obergefell and of course, here in Masterpiece Cake Shop. Mm-hmm. And the left is looking at this, expecting this guy to, take it another measure further and say, of course, we're going to force a Christian baker to bake a cake for a gay wedding. And they didn't do that, but they also didn't defend the religious objection, exactly.
So, everybody was expecting a blockbuster ruling on the merits to define what religious rights dissenters have who object to participating in, same-sex religious ceremonies, or conversely, how far the right to have your marriage recognized by the law, how far that goes. And what we got instead was almost like a technical disqualification, that Kennedy said, Jack Phillips gets off this time because you used some nasty language disparaging his objections as despicable. But the irony is, if you go back and look at the cases, and, Obergefell, the same-sex marriage case, didn't just spring out of nowhere in 2015.
Right.
He was laid the groundwork over the 20 years. The first decision, Romer versus Evans in 1996, he actually said that the voters of Colorado, and it's ironic that it was Colorado, who wanted to make it harder to amend their civil rights statute to include sexual orientation. He said the only reason why the voters would have enacted that is if it were some sort of irrational animus. And then in 2003, when he wrote the majority opinion recognizing the right to engage in homosexual sodomy as a constitutional right, he said that any law criminalizing homosexual behavior lacked any legitimate state interest. And then he wrote the majority opinion in Obergefell, which overruled two millennia of Judeo-Christian opposition to homosexual relations and certainly to homosexual marriage.
Yeah, well, so, it wasn't just a Judeo-Christian history. I mean, it's really kind of out of pretty much every civilization. And the irony, the crazy logic of Obergefell is, you know, hey, you know, I think the court would say, you know, if you ask anyone, do you create law? Do you make law? And they say, no, we interpret law, which, you know, is a lie, but is one of those lies that everybody agrees with. And they would say, we don't make law. So the logic is that there has been this right to compel states to recognize homosexual marriage. It's been resting in the Constitution at least since the 14th Amendment, so basically 150 years. And we just have all been missing it for all these years. Yeah. No, they just saw it. Here it is. Oh, yeah, you hadn't read between the lines.
Well, it's an invisible ink, and you can only see it if you're wearing the magic goggles that only the Supreme Court justices get to put on. Yeah, it's kind of silly, but... So here I thought, here he is protesting that these commissioners in Colorado were referring to Jack Phillips' religious objections as despicable. And you can use a different word, but when you say that opposition to homosexual behavior is irrational animus, or you say that it has no legitimate state interest, or you're willing to override the wishes of the American public and make something up that, you know, was not adopted by the political process but imposed by judicial edict, that is pretty intolerant towards traditional religious views. So my cynical take on this is that everybody was expecting Kennedy, who may be retiring at the end of this term or certainly will be retiring soon. He's 81 years old. He's been on the court for three decades.
That's right.
That he would, you know, this would be his knockout punch. But I think he started having second thoughts about that, is that does he really want to go out leaving the court with this, what would be a very controversial ruling? I think a lot of Americans who read about this case and saw, you know, it on the news sympathized with Jack Phillips.
Well, and it's clear that his objections were sincere. I mean, the man put himself through a real ringer to defend his religious rights, and, you know, is missing out on significant business and having to go through all of this with sincerity. I think, you know, the public looks at it. It's not a phony baloney thing. It's a very real thing.
No, the facts were very strong in his favor, and it wasn't just a moral objection. It was, you know, he was a born-again Christian. These were very sincere, religious views that he had, and there would have been no easy way to decide this case on the merits without, you know, basically antagonizing a lot of Americans who would perhaps sour. You know, that is one thing to create these rights, and it's another thing to resolve conflicting rights in a way that undermines views that a lot of Americans share.
Well, part of the thrust of your article about this is that Kennedy has abused his authority as a justice to advance policy in an arena that he prefers, and has advanced this policy of gay rights using the courts, and that's going to create real negative, problematic consequences for religious liberty as we move forward. Yet he doesn't want to take it the full measure and actually do that. He doesn't. You know, it's an out. It's an out to avoid being the bad guy who has to bring the hammer down on this, you know, sympathetic Christian baker. He can let somebody do that down the line for him and save his reputation as, you know, being clean-handed.
Exactly. That activist judges are seeking the approval of certain audiences who pay close attention to what the Supreme Court is doing. And those audiences basically consist of the elite media and the legal academy, the law professors. This case was a little bit different in that it attracted, and it's very rare to have a case that attracts this type of public attention, where the entire nation was watching, and he's thinking, well, geez, I'm not going to get applause if I rule against Jack Phillips. I'm going to get scorned. And I don't want to be scorned, particularly as I'm kind of polishing my halo to perhaps depart from the court. The thing that really leaves a bad taste in my mouth is, you know, after 30 years of Tony Kennedy and his swing vote and wishy-washy, unpredictable outcomes, is that he sits in the seat that Ronald Reagan intended for Robert Bork.
Wow, and yeah, it was,
in 1987, the Senate shamefully denied him confirmation. And then Tony Kennedy wasn't the second choice. He was the third choice. That Reagan then tried to put Doug Ginsburg on the Supreme Court. And Doug Ginsburg, who was on the D.C. Circuit at the time, had to withdraw his nomination because of the revelation that he had once been seen smoking marijuana at a party, which now seems ridiculous.
Yeah, it's like
Nancy
comical.
Reagan, yeah, Nancy Reagan was, you know, running the Just Say No campaign. And so we ended up with Anthony Kennedy, and this is his sorry legacy. He's finding technical reasons to have to avoid ruling against Jack Phillips because this jurisprudential thing, that this you know, Frankenstein monster that he's created, is now on a campaign of terror headed towards the village.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Wait, real quick, you know, before we finish, one of the interesting things in your article was a little bit of tea reading about the Trump travel ban case, something that I thought was a very interesting observation, impressed me. I kind of felt embarrassed I hadn't noticed this when I read the case. But basically, this ruling came down to statements made by the Colorado Civil Rights Commission, you know, by the commissioners, and the whole issue in the travel ban case is, you know, do Trump's statements outside of the policymaking process on the travel ban have any impact on its legality? And you kind of made an interesting observation about that.
Well, yes, and the fact that in the language that Kennedy's opinion used seemed to be slicing the salami pretty thin, so they said that here the comments of this Colorado Civil Rights Commission were damning because they were not just a lawmaker, they were an adjudicatory body, that these, you know, commissioners actually sit sort of as judges. And so the fact that they're pointing out that they're an adjudicatory body, not just a lawmaker, struck me as being, why would you go, you know, why would you be parsing it that much? Well, we have another case which has yet to be decided. It's going to be decided in the next 2 or 3 weeks, where the left is claiming that President Trump's executive orders restricting travel from certain countries is invalid because of statements he made as a candidate that could be interpreted as anti-Muslim animus. And so they're saying that basically the travel ban is discriminatory, reflects this discriminatory animus, and is therefore invalid. And my theory here is that Kennedy is going to join the conservatives in rejecting that argument, and he's using the fact that President Trump's not an adjudicatory body. He is just a lawmaker, and that the statements that he made were as a candidate in any event, as president.
I just think it's a very interesting, I think you're right, and I think it's a very interesting perspective. Well, we're running out of time. Before we finish, tell listeners where can they go to read your article, Having Your Cake and Eating It Too, as well as your other writing?
Well, the article that we're talking about appeared in American Greatness, which is on the Internet. Just Google American Greatness. I have my own blog, Misrule of Law, and I collect pretty much everything I write everywhere I write, and I do, you know, write for a number of different publications on my website. So if you have listeners who are interested in tracking down any of this, the one-stop shop is Misrule of Law.
Well, thank you for coming on today, Mark, and I appreciate your writing about this. Very on point, very interesting, and like a lot of the stuff we saw. So appreciate you. Thank you for joining us. We'll have to have you back on the next time we have a big legal issue.
My pleasure.
Have you heard about the Texas Torchbearers Program? It's a program that makes activism fun and exciting. You can sign up at texastorchbearers.com. There, you can learn about the easiest and most effective ways to engage your government officials to hold them accountable. As a Texas Torchbearer, you can earn cool prizes like an awesome pair of custom-fit cowboy boots with the Texas Torchbearer logo on it, or even a beautiful custom-engraved 9mm Glock handgun. Sign up today at texastorchbearers.com.
Well, the 4th of July is right around the corner, and this week's radio commentary, Michael Quinn Sullivan tells us why we should also be thinking about the 5th of July.
What if on July 5th, 1776, the men who approved the Declaration of Independence casually headed home, believing their work to be done? With the Texas Scorecard Radio Commentary, I'm Michael Quinn Sullivan. Each Independence Day, I think of my ancestor, Benjamin Rush, a signer of the Declaration of Independence. 2 centuries and numerous generations later, I take great inspiration from what he and his colleagues committed to in the summer of 1776. Just imagine how different the world would be had they not approached independence with a passionate commitment to liberty. Which brings me back to my question. What if on Friday, July 5th, 1776, the men who approved the Declaration of Independence casually headed home thinking their work was done? Sure, they had declared the equality of men and extolled the inalienable rights to life and liberty, and it must have felt good to vent frustrations about the king. But what if each man decided the talk of liberty shouldn't inconvenience anyone too much that weekend? Well, there would have been no new nation conceived in liberty. Rather than old glory, our public spaces would today be festooned with the Union Jack or worse. The world would be a darker place. As a legal document, which is what the Declaration of Independence was under the terms of the Magna Carta, only John Hancock, as the President of Congress, actually had to sign it. But the others signed as well. After all, they had boldly pledged their lives, fortunes, and sacred honor to the cause of independence and liberty. No limits to that pledge. For them, everything was on the line. The cause of liberty was wrapped up in every facet of their lives. They saw the fight for political liberty as inextricably linked to providing for their families, serving in their churches, and ensuring the long-term prosperity of their neighbors. They didn't know if they would be hung the next week, bankrupted the next month, expelled from social circles the next year, or lost forever in the ash heap of history. But they believed in the righteousness of the cause. They knew liberty, as messy and inconvenient as it might be, was worth it for themselves and their prosperity. Let's not forget that it wasn't just those 56 signers who birthed our nation more than 2 centuries ago. Tens of thousands fought against the crown and for liberty, giving life to our democratic republic. Over the course of the War of Independence, the fields of America were watered by the blood of men, young and old, who believed dying for a chance of messy liberty was better than living under the yoke of a cultured and manicured tyranny. Even as so many of their names are lost to us in history, their legacy is this brilliant city set shining upon a hill. They gave their lives to securing the blessings of liberty. That's what they were willing to do the day after the 4th of July in 1776. In this year, once the parades conclude, the barbecues end, and the fireworks have exploded, what will we do for the cause of liberty on the 5th of July? That's the day that counts, and each day after. While it's good to celebrate our national independence, we must daily take actions to preserve our national liberty. Every day. The cause of liberty in our cities, counties, schools, state, nation, it needs us more than ever, and it's still worth it every day. With the Texas Scorecard Radio Commentary, I'm Michael Quinn Sullivan.
Well, that's all the time we have for you this week. Enjoy your 4th of July and join us back here next week for another episode of Texas Scorecard Radio.
Texas Scorecard Radio is brought to you each week as a public service from the Empower Texans Foundation and in partnership with the Lincoln Institute and this station. You can download podcasts from each program and learn more at empowertexans.com.